Welcome back, podcast listeners. What follows is a presentation that I gave on April 25th, 2017 at a conference on affordable medicines held by the Conference Board of Canada, and it's on reproductive tourism. So enjoy. I'm going to talk about reproductive tourism, which is about a $6 billion global industry per year. It affects maybe a few hundred thousand, maybe a few million people, which is not a lot globally. But it subtends the hot-button topics, life, death, family, identity. So how we deal with this issue ultimately helps us understand how to deal with the larger issues that affect us in society. I want to start by thanking T. Din for giving me the title of this presentation. I'm not clever enough to have thought of this myself. How do I do this? There we go. So I'll be giving you some data from some of the studies that my team has done. A lot of what I'll talk about today is from this particular paper. You can get this off of the slides later on. And as well, some colleagues and I have a free book called Traveling Well, Essays in Medical Tourism that you can download from that link too. Our story begins with the demand, infertility. Infertility, believe it or not, is a global epidemic. Right, and amazingly, infertility is also hereditary. Isn't that weird? So if your parents couldn't have kids, you can't have kids. It's complicated. So it affects about 15% of couples, and the confounding element there is you don't know you're infertile until you're trying to have kids. So maybe you are infertile, this audience, right now, and you don't know it because you're not trying yet. And we think it affects about a billion people around the world, probably more. And I'm only talking about biological infertility, not social infertility. Social infertility is what we call it when same-sex couples want to have kids. They can't do it, quote-unquote, naturally. They need assistance through technology to assist them. And we think this phenomenon, the biological infertility, is on the rise in Western nations for a number of reasons. Most commonly, because people are waiting later in life to have kids. In Canada, the age at which a mother has her first child has moved from the early 20s to the mid-30s over the past 50 years or so. As well, we have increases in obesity and diabetes that affect fertility, and we think there may be some environmental issues which are controversial. I won't get into them today, but the picture there shows women drinking soy milk, maybe soy products or estrogenic, who knows, maybe. All this stuff is controversial. The point is, we have a demand. So when the demand comes up, we need products and services to fill that demand. And people travel seeking these services if they're unavailable locally for a number of reasons. When an individual crosses international border seeking reproductive services, we call this reproductive tourism. Some people prefer to call it cross-border reproductive care, or CBRC, because it's less frivolous sounding. So that's what the government likes to call it, so we'll probably use that term throughout this presentation. Here are the services that they typically travel for. Most commonly, looking for gametes, eggs and sperm, etc. Eggs are globally valuable. There's a $1 billion egg trade market. Visit one of these egg websites one day. It's like a dating site. It's fascinating. Maybe not. And sperm are relatively cheap, more so in U.S. and Canada. IVF, test tube babies, we're all familiar with that. There's something called ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, which is where we sort of compel an egg to be intimate with the sperm physically. And it's very rare now to find IVF without ICSI. They're kind of combined now. And this thing called PGD, or pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. This is when we test genetically for certain diseases like Huntington's or Tay-Sachs. But as well, you could conceivably test for height, eye color, skin color, sex, all these fun eugenics things that we like to talk about in the dark corners of the lab. So PGD is on the rise too. And what most of my research surrounds is surrogate mothers. So people travel now to hire other women to have their babies for them. And that's a growing industry. So where are these services provided? All over the world. Every region of the world has a service provider for reproductive tourists. Mexico, Russia, Georgia, Nepal's on the rise, Thailand. But the world leader is unmistakably India. So this graph was put together by a colleague of mine who did a cursory examination of websites for reproduction clinics around the world and where they are located. Malaysia, 3 clinics. Japan, 3 clinics. India, 580 clinics. And that's a severe underestimate. This was almost 10 years ago, so the number has increased substantially. And the title of this conference is Affordable Medicines. So we have to talk about money, right? So this complicated little chart breaks down the price of seeking reproductive services, in this case IVF. So the red line there, Canada. When you talk about IVF, you have to look at it by the age of the person seeking services. The older we are, the harder it is to find success. So the first column is for women under 35. So a Canadian woman will spend, I can't see that far, $34,000 or so, and it'll probably take her 3 to 4 attempts to get pregnant. If she's over 44, it'll take her 100 attempts on average, and that'll cost her over $500,000. In India, which is the green line down there, those two numbers are about $2,000 and $80,000. So the economic gradient is profound. India can offer these services much more inexpensively than Western countries can. So one of our studies looked at where these Indian clinics are clustered. They're clustered in the business centers in Maharashtra and Gujarat, which are also closely associated with other tourist opportunities. We looked at how they advertise their services, and we found that a lot of these clinics are overtly catering to foreign clientele. So this graph just shows us, are they overtly mentioning reproductive tourists or slyly offering them? So that's on the increase as well. Why India? A number of reasons. First, as I mentioned, the economic gradient, the exchange rate is advantageous. Second, we have a high number of well-trained English-speaking doctors because every Indian mother wants their son or daughter to be a doctor. Right, so that's an Indian joke because I'm brown, I'm allowed. Put it away. Thank you. Thank you, fellow brown person. That's good. So as well, we have this cooperative state. What does that mean? The Indian government funds press junkets, or rather junkets around the world for showing off their medical tourist facilities. So they are engaged in marketing these services, and maybe there's a partnership between government and industry in making the laws a bit more forgiving towards reproductive tourists. There is an established medical tourism infrastructure in a country like India, so there's already a process by which a travel agent can get together with an airline, get together with a hotelier, and other kinds of opportunities to make traveling for these services seamless. And lastly, there's a cultural issue here, the perception of Indian women as being docile, non-drinking, non-partying, therefore appropriate receptacles for our babies. So, who are the clientele? The clientele we thought were mostly couples from Western countries. That's changing. So when I used to visit these clinics several years ago, I would see all white faces in an Indian clinic. Now I'm seeing more and more brown faces because with the expansion of the Indian middle class, they themselves are hiring surrogate mothers because a lot of this infertility stuff comes out of becoming wealthier, fatter, waiting later in life to have kids, etc. So the demographics are changing. However, there is still a large proportion of Westerners seeking these services. Who are reproductive tourists and medical tourists in general? We like to categorize medical tourists in two categories. Either they're quality sensitive or they're price sensitive. A quality sensitive tourist is someone who is looking for high quality care, willing to travel to get it and to pay top dollar for it. A price sensitive tourist is someone who's looking for a deal. Somewhere in the middle is someone looking for stuff that's unavailable here. So maybe the laws, the technologies are somehow restricting you accessing it locally. We think that a CBRC tourist, a cross-border reproductive care tourist, is somewhere that's either price-sensitive or seeking services that aren't accessible here. And why aren't they accessible here? Well, there are legal restrictions that affect our ability to access reproductive services. They are either restrictions on who can access them or restrictions on what they can access. Regarding who? Some countries prevent people above a certain age from getting these services, or single people, or same-sex couples, etc. A lot of countries prohibit things like payment for eggs and sperm or for surrogates. Canada prohibits payment for these things. In general, though, all these tourists share some common characteristics. Among them, they want a child who is genetically their own and they're willing to pay to get access to that child. Okay. The surrogate mothers and gamete donors, we don't really know what their motivations are. We suspect it's largely financial. But there's some contingent that believes there's an element of altruism and even a religiosity here. So the Indian surrogate mothers, some of them will say, it is my religious duty to help lift the curse of infertility from my foreign sisters who suffer from this ghastly condition. So what are the risks? In general, the risks are to the people traveling, the people giving the services, to the children produced, to the clinics, etc. But quickly, the risks to the source country, the one that is providing people who are traveling, tend to be legal or economic. If I'm spending my money elsewhere, I'm not spending it here. And values-based. If people are traveling to avoid a law that prohibits them getting service here, and we are not enforcing that law, there's tacit approval for the violation of that law, one could argue. The risk to the destination country are also financial. For example, if India's tax base is spending a lot of money producing doctors, should not their citizens benefit from the production of all those doctors? Why is that service going to foreigners? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And running out of time, so I'll say the values-based element here are things like, there's a famous case of an Indian surrogate mother giving a child to two gay Israeli men, and as a result, she was ostracized from her village. So there is a values-based element that was brought into a society that was perhaps not ready for that sort of approach. And so their values were in conflict. There are risks to the people seeking care. In general, if you are traveling to seek reproductive services, you are vulnerable. You're probably in debt. You're definitely financially stressed. You're vulnerable to quacks, science exploitation, things like that. And for the surrogate mothers, we have the regular social and risks, like being ostracized. You have the physical and emotional risks that come from being pregnant. A couple of case studies. First is baby Gami. Baby Gami was the product of a Thai surrogate mother producing a child for an Australian couple. Now, she's pregnant with two babies. One had Down syndrome. The Australian couple asked her to abort that child. She refused for religious reasons. When the child was born, the Australian couple took the non-Down syndrome child and refused to accept the Down syndrome child. So now we have a question is, who owns the baby, who has rights to the baby, who has responsibilities for the baby. These things were not codified in law beforehand. As a result of this, Thailand now bans surrogacy for foreigners. It's further complicated because the Australian man turned out to be a registered sex offender. And so that brings up the question, should there be restrictions on who's allowed to enter surrogacy relationships? Baby Manji is a case in India where a Japanese couple hired an Indian surrogate mother using a donor egg but his sperm. While waiting for the baby, they got divorced. So after the divorce, the Japanese woman did not want the baby, but the man did. However, Indian law does not allow single men to adopt children, even if he is genetically theirs. So that created a crisis as well. For a lot of these cases, a child is stateless until it's adopted, which is another policy problem here. So in both of those case studies, we have a situation where the technology is moving faster than the law can keep up. So the law struggles to make policies to accommodate things that have already come to pass. A quick note on ethical issues. I want to distinguish between medical ethics and business ethics. In medical ethics, we like to think about that doctors and clinicians are looking after your best interests. Business ethics is about taking care of your own best interests. So, for example, if your company is going bankrupt, I'm within my ethical rights to buy your assets at below market rates because you're desperate to sell. Even though that may affect you and your employees negatively, that's not my responsibility. That way of thinking is not relevant in medical ethics, where we have to think about the wherewithal of all the parties concerned. Medical tourism is about the conflict between medical ethics and business ethics. So one way of thinking about this when it comes to surrogacy is that the clinic is acting as a broker. The client, the foreign couple, is the client seeking services. The surrogate is providing these services, and the product is a baby. There's innate conflicts of interest here that we have not worked out legally or ethically. For example, if there's a situation where the clinician must choose between, let's say, the life of the surrogate and the life of the baby, there's a financial incentive to choose for the baby, but a moral incentive to choose for either one. How do we reconcile that conflict? It's unclear. Last slide. I just want to summarize here. So medical tourism, reproductive tourism, CBRC, whatever you want to call it, it's a global multi-billion dollar industry. It subtends these big hot button issues, life, death, family, identity, all these great things. And everyone is vulnerable. The surrogates, those seeking care, even the clinics are legally vulnerable, and definitely the children are vulnerable too. They can end up stateless. So the underlying question that begins all of this is reproduction a right or a privilege? If it's a right, then we're saying by not having this all funded by government, we're saying that among the infertile, only the wealthy can reproduce. If it's a privilege, then we are justified somewhat in shunting this into the private sector entirely. What we haven't talked about is the rights of the next generation. What are their rights with respect to making sure there's contiguousness of care and having their genes not messed with, having PGD done, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a ripe area for further ethical investigation and a ripe area for policy development as well. That is all. Thank you very much.